The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Another Obama trip to Riyadh, and there's not much pomp and ceremony. In fact, if there is one place where you can find little evidence of global warming, it's between Washington and Saudi Arabia, where the chill is a carved ice elephant in the room that won't be melting when King Salman and President Obama once again shake chilly hands. Iran's nuclear deal will be helping to chill the proceedings, along with disagreements over oil policy, the civil war in Yemen, ISIS, the refugee crisis in Syria, Russia's role in the region, and there's plenty of backup chill coming from Congress set to vote on a bill that would hold the Saudi government responsible for involvement in the 9/11 attacks and punishing the country by limiting sales of military arms. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, sponsoring the bill, will explain why Saudi Arabia and why now in just a moment. But first, we turn to Robin Wright, joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker.
There is deep suspicion between the two capitals that the relationship between the king, who's been in office now for only 16 months, and President Obama are not great. There are certain realities about the relationship. Both countries need each other, but the greater independence of the U.S. oil market has impacted, obviously, the dependence the United States has on imported oil. And that, of course, was the foundation of that relationship. But it's also an interesting time in Saudi Arabia's evolution. This is a country that faces now threats militarily on its northern border with ISIS moving into Iraq and Syria, and on its southern border with Al-Qaeda operating in Yemen, and, of course, a violent civil war in which Saudi Arabia is playing the dominant role. So this is a very different dynamic than it was the last time they met.
Is the Yemen conflict more about Al-Qaeda, or is it more about a proxy war with Iran, in that the Houthis are believed to be ostensibly Shiite, but you get differing reports as to whether they're actually proxies for Iran or not?
Well, Saudi Arabia clearly feels that Yemen's future will impact whatever happens inside Saudi Arabia. The civil war there played out both tribally and in sectarian terms. And of course, the Saudis are worried because the Houthis in the past have had a relationship with Iran. But it's not nearly the equivalent of what Iran has with, for example, Lebanon's Hezbollah or Syria's President Bashar Assad. It's a different nature of a relationship. But Saudi Arabia is now viewing many of its security threats, its economic threats, even the balance of power in the region, through the prism of Iran's growing role, particularly its growing acceptance in the aftermath of a nuclear deal that was implemented in January after 2 years of serious international negotiations.
Does the Saudi government see beyond Barack Obama at this point and look forward to some warming relationship with potentially one of the candidates? I mean, you've got this initiative in the Congress to blame Saudi Arabia for the 9/11 attacks years after that happened, and to bring that up can only just chill things worse.
The kingdom is clearly looking forward to a different kind of relationship under new administration. But at the same time, your question points out the fundamental problem between Riyadh and Washington, and that is there is growing suspicion, not just of whoever is resident in the White House, but what's happening in Congress as well. And there's a sense that in a Republican-led Congress, you see growing efforts, punitive efforts against Saudi Arabia. And so it's this broader tension that the relationship is eroding more than it has been, let's say, since any time since 1973 and the oil price hike. There's, you know, this fundamental question about, can Saudi Arabia rely on the United States? And of course, there are growing questions in Washington about, is Saudi Arabia the kind of ally the United States really wants and values long term?
Robin Wright, joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Robin, thanks as always.
Thank you, John.
The U.S.-Saudi relationship has been one the U.S. Congress has been keen to weigh in on, whether to claim the U.S. is making Israel less secure by selling arms to the Saudis, or relying too much on Saudi Arabia for regional stability, to whether Saudi Arabia is an ally in the war on terror. According to congressional researchers, the United States has sold over $100 billion in arms to Saudi Arabia since 2010. There is a $1.3 billion deal to replenish Saudi bomb stockpiles working its way to a vote. But a Senate bill wants to freeze arms sales to Saudi Arabia. The bill is co-sponsored by Republican Senator from Kentucky Rand Paul and Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick spoke with Senator Murphy about how this bill looks with the president on an official Saudi visit.
We own the Saudi conduct inside Yemen. And so if you talk to Yemenis, they will tell you that this is a U.S.-Saudi bombing campaign, not a Saudi-U.S. bombing campaign, a U.S.-Saudi bombing campaign. And so when you look at the thousands of civilians that have been killed, we have to go into this with eyes wide open that we are going to be perceived to own those civilian casualties inside Yemen. I think there's some misbelief that because we aren't actually dropping the bombs out of U.S. planes, that we won't be held responsible. We are held responsible.
Let's talk about eyes wide open, because even if you're completely correct in terms of the principled view of providing these types of weapons to the Saudis when they're engaged in this kind of war, the Saudis provide an important role for U.S. foreign policy. There is a delicate, if not unsavory, balance of power in the Middle East. The Saudis are an important ballast against Iran. They are putatively on our side against ISIS, although sometimes that seems to be in doubt. So limiting these weapon sales in a way that you and others are proposing, it could be argued, is upsetting a careful balance that we use to keep other bad actors in the region at bay.
Well, let's talk about the conditions that I'm proposing to apply to this sale. I'm proposing that the Saudis make a commitment not to use cluster bombs, that they don't target civilians, and that they make a commitment to go after terrorists like AQAP and ISIL with as much vigor as they use to go after the Houthis. I don't know how anybody here in the United States Congress can argue with that, and I would challenge the Saudis to explain to us why that wouldn't result in a, I think, fundamentally productive balance of their security interests and our security interests. You know, when we signed the Iran nuclear agreement, we didn't sign up to back the Saudis' play in each and every instance that they choose to go to war against Iran in the region. I think that would be a very dangerous byproduct of the Iran nuclear agreement.
I talked to one senior Democratic source in a position to know when I asked, what about the Murphy-Paul Saudi weapons bill? The answer I got back was two words: no chance.
I understand what I'm doing and what Senator Paul is doing is countercultural. You know, when you get sworn into Congress, you are told that the Saudis are a sacred ally of the United States. I don't want to walk away from that alliance, not in the least. I just want our policy to underscore the complexity of the relationship. And I want our arms sales to try to push the Saudis into a more productive stance in the region, a greater willingness to take on terrorists rather than just Iran, and into a conversation about how some of the funding sources that come out of Saudi Arabia actually end up funding the very building blocks of the extremist movement that we're trying to fight.
Senator Chris Murphy, thank you.
Thank you.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick speaking to Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut. The Taliban struck hard in central Kabul, Afghanistan today. Suicide bombers targeted a building housing an Afghan security force, something like the U.S. Secret Service. Dozens were killed, hundreds injured. The attack continued after the explosion as Taliban fighters stormed through the compound, killing and wounding police who returned fire in extended gun battles across central Kabul. Mujeeb Mashal is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome to The Takeaway, Mujeeb.
Thanks for having me, John.
So the Taliban took responsibility, and there seems to be no doubt that they're behind this.
Yeah, they took pretty clear responsibility, even when the attack was underway, actually. They've been pretty swift in their media operations, their PR operations, claiming such attacks. It was a very deadly attack. compared to others that have happened in Kabul in recent years. The explosion was massive. It rattled windows across the city. And just the numbers, I mean, the numbers tell the story. More than 300 people wounded and about 30 people dead. But officials are saying very clearly that those numbers could go up because the area was so crowded.
Why target this Department 10 security unit?
I guess the symbolic value also. These guys, this elite force, are the protection for the senior government officials. So in a way, the Taliban are sending a message that we can actually target your protection. The fact of the matter is that, yes, they targeted that unit, but a lot of the people who died and a lot of and the people who were wounded were civilians.
What is the state of the military conflict between the Taliban and Afghan forces now that the allies are not fighting even remotely as hard or as visibly as Afghan forces who are supposed to take up the vacuum here?
The Afghan forces have taken up the lead. They took the lead last year in fighting and in defending Afghanistan, and they had a very difficult year. Especially the army struggled hard against casualties and desertions and medevac and issues like that. The police has, you know, been battle-tested a little longer. They struggle a lot. The year was very tough for the Afghan forces. The government officials say about 6,000 police and army were killed in 2015. And a lot of other sources would suggest that the number is actually higher than that, and about 15,000 or so wounded. Unlike previous years, the fighting did not really slow down during winter months, but the fighting raged in sort of similar levels. And now that the Taliban have declared their annual offensive, a lot of people are wondering, so if the fighting did not really slow down in the winter, what does the launch of a spring offensive mean?
And so therefore, it's much less likely that there would be any discussions between the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban about any kind of peace or ceasefire.
The government of Ashraf Ghani, which is a coalition government that has struggled with infighting, they made it a priority to reach out to the Taliban during the winter months in the hopes that they could prevent the bloodshed that is happening right now in the spring. But those efforts did not go anywhere. They were busy sort of discussions involving China, Pakistan, the United States to try to force the Taliban to the negotiating table. And Pakistan is a crucial element in this because the leadership of the Taliban are based in Pakistan and because it is believed for the longest time, and there's a decent consensus around this, that there are elements within the Pakistani intelligence service that uses the Taliban as a proxy force. And in a way, they see the coming year, just like they saw last year, as a year that they could test the Afghan security forces when they're alone on their own. Yes, there is a NATO element. The U.S. is still providing some air support. The U.S. and NATO is providing a training and advising to the Afghan forces. But in the combat, in the battlefield, the Afghan forces are mostly on their own. And the Taliban have declared that they want to see their chances against
them. Mujeeb Mashal is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, based in Kabul. Mujeeb, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
We've been exploring, along with PBS and Chicago station WTTW these past weeks, how places we live signify large changes in the American way of life. Some of those changes have been for good and some for ill. Some have steered us back from choices that have turned out to be mistakes. This country is struggling right now to deal with consequences from cars and highways. Washington, D.C.'s Langston Terrace dwellings was a great idea, we learned, as were the parks, like Seattle's freeway and gasworks parks, recycling industrial sites. Tonight, the series examines 10 towns that changed America. Jeffrey Baer is host and senior editor of the series. He looks at the contrast between places like Levittown, Long Island, an early post-war suburb, to the Pearl District of Portland, Oregon, an experimental neighborhood that is moving away from reliance on automobiles.
We've always had this question of what is the right kind of way we want to live in towns and cities. And some of those proved to be not very good ideas. Levittown gobbled up acres and acres and acres of land. The only way to live there was if you had a car. There was no way to walk anywhere. And it was replicated all over the country. The latest ideas in planning, which are much more about sustainability, I do think many people hope that we'll be seeing more and more of this, small blocks, walkable. Is your city going to build a streetcar tomorrow? No. It's a very difficult thing to do. But in little ways, we hope to see transit-oriented design replicated in places all over the country to the extent possible.
Would you say that the ideas of today are good ideas? Have all of them learned lessons from some of the past change-oriented structures and architectures and design features that we've put on the shelf, like Levittown?
You know, I have a bias. I tend to like the idea of living in a more compact, walkable area. It's very hard to get people to give up their cars. So we have this fantasy about what we want. But, you know, getting people to really get out of their cars, to really walk. I've been all over the country making this series. And everywhere I go, I try to take the streetcar or the light rail or whatever kind of transit there is from the airport to get into town. I was in Salt Lake City, and there's a wonderful streetcar connection right from downtown Salt Lake City to the airport. You can't get closer. And we were asking people, you know, where do we pick up the streetcar? Is it 3 blocks from here or 2 blocks from here? And everybody was saying, oh, we've never taken the streetcar to the airport. I don't know how to get to the airport on the streetcar. It couldn't be easier.
Part of that is the motivation for Portland. In the Pearl District, for instance, the places that, you know, were once abandoned now look like their own kind of movie set. I mean, the Powell Bookstore is like this fantasy bookstore in an era of Barnes & Noble, and yet it really represents a vital, you know, revitalization of a fantastic traditional neighborhood in Portland.
It really is a tremendous example of a kind of a prototypical development for the 21st century. You know, it was just this giant railroad yard and a lot of industrial buildings, like big warehouse buildings that had fallen out of use. A lot of the railroad yard had fallen out of use. And Portland figured out a way. This took decades to happen. This kind of thing does not happen quickly. They took their lovely small street grid of downtown Portland and pushed it out into what used to be a railroad yard and an industrial warehouse district. And then the real key to it, it's not the whole key, but it's one of the real keys to it, was the streetcar. They said, you know, we're gonna run a streetcar out into this new neighborhood that we're creating, which some say was called the Pearl because it was like a jewel, like a little pearl that was found inside an ugly oyster shell. We interviewed the man who actually was sort of behind the whole streetcar effort. Why a streetcar? Why not just run buses into the neighborhood? And he said, because when you put those rails down the middle of the street, you are telling developers, we are here to stay. You know, a bus, if this doesn't work out, they can, you know, the bus can go away tomorrow. And it's also a mixed use neighborhood. So you live there, you work there, you play there, you dine there, you shop there, you walk the streets. There's a whole lot of elements that make this a kind of a prototypical neighborhood for, you know, what we're trying to do in the 21st century.
How has the aesthetic changed in the things that you looked at over time? For instance, you have a comparison of St. Augustine, Florida, which is, oh my goodness, that goes back centuries. And yes. Then, of course, Portland is a very different, you know, kind of urban planning that is going on today in other cities that you can see. Are we shifting from European models to prototypically American models as we look over the historical arc here in all of these examples?
Well, all of these towns are designed, starting with, you know, the oldest one in America, St. Augustine, all the way up to today. These are not places that sort of grew organically at a crossroads. So your point about aesthetics is a good one. What should they look like? And it's interesting because the first three in the program, which are St. Augustine, Philadelphia, and Salt Lake City, are grids. Rectilinear grids. I mean, they're efficient, but are they sort of oppressive and inhuman? So you get Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park in New York, designs this suburb in the 1800s in Chicago called Riverside, Illinois. And it's all about curving streets and creating these views as you round a bend. It's supposed to be more pastoral and scenic. So there was definitely a reaction to the grid in that way to try to sort of find something a little more human. And you see these curvilinear streets replicated even down to, places like Levittown. But then, of course, Portland, we're back to the grid. You were asking about a European model. Many of these old, old European cities were not designed by anybody. They sort of grew organically along donkey paths. And
right.
So, you know, they're a rabbit warren of twisted streets and narrow lanes and things, and even places like Boston, for example, in this country. But this sort of American kind of – I should correct myself. Certainly the grid is not American. It goes back to the Romans, you know. But this very tight urban grid that we see in Portland, I do think is a return to that more walkable human scale.
Well, having opinions about design and deciding to go for it on their own is what changed America to begin with. And it's the premise of your program. Jeffrey Baer, thanks so much.
It was just a pleasure to be here.
Jeffrey Baer is host and senior editor of the PBS series 10 That Changed America, produced by WTTW in Chicago. 200 years ago, more than that really, when the U.S. of A. vowed to go it alone from King George and embrace democracy and freedom, the world has been asking the question about every 4 years.
What comes next? You've been freed. Do you know how hard it is to lead? You're on your own. Awesome. Wow. Do you have a clue what happens now?
I know I still have to win the nomination. I'm working hard every day to do that.
Now, I got to tell you, I paid for this because I operated in obscurity for the entire time.
We win caucuses and primaries when the voter turnout is high.
Lion Ted Cruz talked about New York values with anger and really hatred.
I look forward to beating whichever socialist wins the Democratic nomination.
Well, it's the New York primary, the main event right now in the 2016 presidential contest. The candidates have spoken. We take you now to the streets of New York, where liberty is playing itself out in the grand narrative of democracy. From the chilly northern ice of Watertown, New York, I am voting for Donald Trump, one of you says in the primary. Since I'm registered Republican, I want either Trump or Sanders to be elected, preferably Sanders, because either candidate is going to turn the two-party system upside down.
Oceans rise, empires fall. It's much harder when it's all your call. All alone across the sea, when your people say they hate you, don't come crawling back to me.
I'm voting for Hillary Rodham Clinton. She's the most qualified candidate in my lifetime. She cares, she's compassionate, she's practical. She has the experience to get the job done.
I am voting for Bernie Sanders. He has kept Hillary Clinton honest, as much as any politician in this climate can be, and he's forced her to answer questions, or dodge them at least, that she would have avoided otherwise.
New York State is used to being important in the Revolutionary War, in the economy. It's the big prize in the delegates right now and relevant for both parties for the first time since the bicentennial in the days of Gerry Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Scoop Jackson, when Donald Trump was just starting out.
His message is very powerful, which is he's saying, take care of our country while we can. Impose limits on people when they come in here, have them respect the laws, just like my parents did when they first came to this country. Otherwise, we have a chaotic society. You have to have rules that you follow.
I want to be like Donald Trump. I want to be successful. I want a helicopter. I don't want socialism.
Deer Park, New York. Bernie, I'm voting for Bernie, but evidently I changed party affiliation 7 days too late. How do I know who I've decided to vote for by October 2015? I've been locked out of this primary. Why is there a law like that? Two-party system, babe. That's the way the cookie crumbles. Got to be in a party in the New York primary.
I would like to partake in the primaries in New York City, but I don't get to because I'm a registered independent, and New York's closed primary leaves me without a voice.
We complain about our democracy and our candidates and how difficult we often make voting, but would we ever have it any other way? Would we trade it all away for another shot being ruled by King George?
This time I'm still in a state of cerebral quagmire. Now, while Hillary represents the establishment and Bernie represents a breath of fresh air, in my eyes, The question is, does Bernie have the chutzpah to stand up to the Putins of the world? Can he be strong enough to be a leader on the world stage? On the other hand, can I trust Hillary to do the right thing?
That poor man, they're going to eat him alive.
President
John Kasich,
Hillary Clinton,
Ted Cruz,
Bernie Sanders,
Donald Trump.
Good luck.
New York primary all day long. Don't forget to vote. Come on, people. Let's show them how it's done. The arduous journey from Syria to Europe in the current migrant crisis makes it harder to remember that the Arab world and Europe actually border each other in the West. For centuries, people have moved from the North African nation of Morocco across the Straits of Gibraltar to Spain and back again. The attacks in Paris and in Brussels in the last 6 months have been reminders of just how much the people of Morocco have merged into the cultures of Europe and where they have not. Of the three radicalized individuals who died in Brussels in March, all were born to Moroccan parents. At least three of the Paris attackers who brutalized the city last November were also second-generation Moroccan immigrants. Today, some 3 million Moroccans live across the Mediterranean, and that is not counting the descendants of earlier immigrants. Meanwhile, Morocco is also a destination for people fleeing conflict zones from the east. So Morocco is both a host and source for migrants. We turn to Kelsey Norman, a doctoral candidate at the University of California.
Prior to the 1990s, it was quite easy to cross the area that you mentioned, the Strait of Gibraltar, from Morocco into Spain. And then after about the year 2000, it became much more difficult to do that. But in 2013, there was this mass policy shift at the governmental level that will now allow irregular migrants who have been in Morocco that meet certain criteria. So, for example, if they've been in Morocco up to 5 years and they can document that, then they're eligible for this regularization campaign.
So it's easier to come to Morocco and get a pathway to citizenship than it would ever be in Europe or the United States.
Well, it's not a pathway to citizenship. But what it is offering is a chance for these migrants who have been there in an irregular position, which made it really hard for them to find work in the formal economy or even to find housing for landlords being willing to accept them. Now they have a chance to have a regular status in Morocco. And hopefully this will also entail things like integration measures at the governmental level.
Do the 3 million Moroccans living in Europe believe they are assimilated, believe they are a part of this European family, or do they feel as though they are always to be the other?
Well, I think it's hard to talk about them as a massive group. It varies so much by country as well, whether Moroccans would be in Belgium or in France or maybe in the Netherlands, and how those different host states have handled integration measures. Many Moroccans see themselves as sort of living these binary lives. You know, they'll have a home in Morocco, but then they also feel very European. And we can talk about second and third generation immigrants who might not have ever grown up in Morocco, and so they only know Europe. But I imagine they're feeling, you know, this backlash from what they consider to be their home in light of what's happened in Paris and in Belgium over the past couple months.
Who are the individuals who would be involved in something like ISIS, and how do they distinguish themselves from the individuals who want to live peacefully? I mean, aside from doing the violence that they do.
Interestingly, those individuals that have defected that we know about and gone to Syria or Iraq are generally second or third generation immigrants. So it's interesting that they are not the people who made a voyage from a place like Morocco themselves. It's, you know, their grandchildren. So I think it speaks more to the failure of integration measures in host states in Europe, as opposed to the inclination of any of these people. It's unlikely you'll see a first generation immigrant defecting because they've gone through such a struggle in order to get to Europe in the first place.
Why does that sense of struggle and sense of bonding go away within the family? How does the struggle of the first generation become an anger by the third generation?
The majority of Moroccans going to France in the 60s and 70s were doing things like working in coal mining, you know, jobs that Europeans themselves did not want because they don't pay well, they're dangerous. So these individuals really had to struggle in order to make it safe and to find themselves in hopefully a regular position for their immigrant children. So I think the children might grow up with a different sort of expectation. They might think of themselves solely as European and yet still face things like xenophobia and racism from society. And so maybe they just never quite feel welcomed.
Kelsey Norman is a doctoral candidate at the University of California, Irvine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mohamed Zefzaf grew up in the Molenbeek neighborhood of Brussels, a neighborhood most recently overrun with cameras, reporters, and police as law enforcement conducted a manhunt for the shooters in the Paris and Brussels attacks. Mohamed Zefzaf's family, originally from Morocco, was one of many who came to Europe after the Second World War as part of a guest worker program. After last month's attack in Brussels, Mohamed said it was important to share another story of Molenbeek, one of strength, resilience, family love, and treasured memories of better times.
I could tell you fantastic, wonderful stories of coming to Brussels when I was 10. And across the street, there was a cafe. It was open almost all night. And one day I heard Ne me quitte pas, which is a Jacques Brel song.
Ne me quitte pas, il faut oublier, tout peut s'oublier. Qui s'enfuit déjà, oublier le temps des malentendus et le temps perdu, à savoir comment.
And I just loved it. And then the old lady, she was like in her 60s then, and we talked about it, she told me about it. And there was a connection between me as a child and this 65-year-old lady, Belgian. And through music, art, we got to a place where I think it was beautiful. And that's the kind of things that we have to exchange, you know, and not hate violence.
What did she give you to eat?
She gave me French fries with mayonnaise.
Of course.
That's the only way to have it.
How would you say the influx of Moroccans in Europe has been affected by all of this turmoil that we've seen in Belgium and France over the last year or so?
Well, I think that certainly it has exasperated the situation. I don't think Europe is ready culturally or probably even economically to deal with such a huge number. And they haven't dealt with the people who have been there for generations. So you can see that what may happen as a result of this influx.
And in the case of the Moroccans, you're really a pioneer community in the sense that Moroccans have been on the move for quite some time, whether we're talking about Moroccan Muslims, Moroccan Jews, Moroccan Christians.
Yes, we have. In fact, we can go back to World War II when Moroccan soldiers fought alongside French soldiers and then the Second World War. And so it goes way back. But in terms of the Moroccans workers, they were part of what was called a guest program in the 50s and 60s, pretty much after the end of the Second World War, where they needed workers, laborers. And so they invited them, in quotation mark here, as guest workers. And when the Moroccans came to Brussels or Europe, it was with the idea, especially from the European side, that they were basically temporary workers, that they would work, build Europe, and then go back home. But, you know, one of the my favorite singer and poet, Jacques Brel, said to that effect that we asked for workers and we got people. People that have children, that have families, that create relationships, and all of that. And I think at the end, the Europeans, Belgium, if you will, in this instance, did not really create anything for them. They were abandoned, left alone in these areas, these ghettos. Now, never really, as I said somewhere before, to condone any of that, but there are reasons when you have a child that is 18 or 19 who has no future, nothing ahead, and you have these people who seduce them with this this philosophy, which, you know, is a philosophy of death. And as a Muslim, I find that abhorrent, but I think it's a very, very complex issue, John. It's not the headlines. It's we have to go at some point beyond the headlines.
Is there a Moroccan nationalism at work here?
You know, Morocco is unique in the sense that, geographically speaking, it is between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, across from Europe and Africa. It has a great deal of influence from many parts of the world for millennia. And so we always had this pride of being unique in that we were always tolerant. But I've been here for a long time. I left Morocco a long time ago. But my identity is Moroccan. It's because of that I can deal with what's happening, and I can deal with a lot of things in my life. That anchor, that what we call what they call in French Marocanité, it is among the Jews in Morocco. It's among the Jews in Israel. It's among the Muslims here. It's in Europe. It's not nationalism. Nationalism is not. That's not the word. The word is more like pride and love for who we are, and we would like to spread that around the world. Now, just on that issue, Morocco, a small country, has created last year a center called the King Mohammed VI International Imam Training Centers, which is in Rabat. And it deals with training imams in the area of the moderate, the tolerant, the loving aspect of Islam. And it so happened now that imams in Russia, France, African countries come to Rabat, to Morocco, and to this beautiful center where they're trying to teach them the moderate aspect of Islam. So people say, we're not doing anything. You have to go down to Rabat, to Morocco, and see what the Moroccans, what they are doing in terms of trying to create what they call a rapprochement between people.
Do you think Europe, on its side, for its part, has missed the chance to develop a standardized strategy regarding immigration, regarding how you're going to be able to work, how you're going to be received, the reception that you're going to get when you arrive in Belgium or France or any other European country?
There have been studies done on this. It's a well-known study called the Chicago Resume, in which you would send two similar resumes.
Bye-bye.
With the identical experience in education, but the names are different. One is Jean, and the other one is Abdullah. And you send that out to 10,000 people. Jean will get 50% more phone calls for a job. This is a fact. So if you are Moroccan or North African living, actually born in Belgium or in France, and you feel rejected by the fact that you can't get a job, you have no prospect, you have no future, surely there's a failure there. But we must, we should, we need to go beyond failure, beyond blaming, beyond finger pointing. Because if we do not, this cycle will continue, sadly. I think it's time to now say, what can we do? Last year, at the climate conference in Paris, 200 countries came together and agreed to cut down carbon emission. Why can't we have 200 ministers of education getting together and creating a curriculum, or perhaps on the basis of the Human Rights Declaration, that we can teach that to our children all over the world, not just the Muslims, everybody? That is, I think, the crux. That's, I think, where we have to go, John.
Mohammed Zafzaf, thank you so much. This year in the upcoming Summer Olympics, you will not find this event, negotiating, individual program, freestyle negotiating, how about negotiating non-negotiable issues or time trial negotiated hostage release? No, these events are not in the Olympics. As much as the World Sporting Competition is declared to be an agent of world peace, actually, negotiating peace, that's just too hard. I mean, there's not enough people that can actually do it, let alone medal in the event. You couldn't get enough people to have an actual event. Daniel Shapiro is the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program and associate professor of psychology at Harvard. If there were to be a team of negotiators, he might be the one to assemble it. In a new book out today, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, How to Resolve Your Most Emotionally Charged Conflicts, Daniel Shapiro joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You start with the hard stuff first in this book, that's for sure.
Life is hard.
Yeah. What, first of all, drew you to this? Because you do seem to be drawn to the really hard stuff, talking about different views of the sacred, for instance. You spend a lot of time in the Middle East in the Israel-Palestine conflict, which seems completely unresolvable at this point.
Yeah, I mean, great. So first, it's great to be here. We are all negotiating all the time. You know, since the day you were born and cried for milk, we've all been negotiating. It's how do we negotiate most effectively? Looking at our world right now, there's no lack of issues that one could try to address in better means. My own work began in Eastern Central Europe, right at the turn of communism, looking to help the transition there from a closed to an open society without violence. How do you do it? Is it even possible?
And can you shift from, say, personal, for lack of a better word, tribal disputes that determine territorial issues on the ground to a more secular sense of shared values that get you beyond those kinds of things, which I think is part of what the Middle East conflict is about? It's not unlike conflicts that take place right here in the United States.
I think there's some core principles that are relevant, whether it is around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or whether it's around my wife and I trying to deal with a conflict in our own lives. You know, so just as an example, in the book, one of the big concepts I talk about, I call it the tribes effect. And it is an adversarial mindset that we tend to get into when we're in conflict with somebody else. And the problem is, once you get in that mindset, it is very difficult to get out.
And that means you declare your identity to be specific and immovable, and that's what you have to really change.
I am right. You are wrong. I am going to defend my case. I am going to close my ears to yours. And whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or, you know, to some degree, my wife and I again in that conflict situation, this is a problematic mindset. You know, in the personal situation, the moment we get into that, my wife and I get into that conflict, this person who I'm married to, who I love, this beautiful person, all of a sudden, she becomes the enemy, you know, and that's a problem, you know, and that's a huge problem when we're dealing with larger political issues, really consequential issues in our world right now.
As a psychological goal, how do you change a person's view of victory in a negotiation from a verdict on their own personal identity to the success of finding common ground for the group or for the pair?
Try to understand the other side's perspective. You know, as simple as this concept sounds, it is incredibly powerful and incredibly difficult to do. When I get called in by government leadership, by businesses and so on, invariably the first thing I hear from them is, how do you deal with someone who is utterly irrational? You know, how do you negotiate? And once I hear those words, that's the telltale sign for me that this might just be negotiable, because they're seeing things through their own perspective, not through the perspective of the other side. And it's not just rational. It's from an emotional perspective. What really is going on? You know, whether, again, it's a family situation or an international, to step into that other side's shoes and really understand what things look like from their perspective, it's transformative.
Is that possible with a group like ISIS, where you step into their shoes and look at them with James Foley's head in their hands, kind of thing?
I mean, what ISIS does is reprehensible. The question is, do we want to negotiate with ISIS? Either formally, probably not, informally, through some back channels, possibly. And if that's the case, absolutely I want to understand their mindset. In order to influence anybody, the most powerful way to do so is to understand what is going on in that other person's mind. If I can understand why the leadership of ISIS or some of the followers are doing what they're doing, I'm much more capable to influence them.
Is it a concession to negotiate? Often in geopolitics, adversaries view it as a concession to even sit down at the table with the other side. And that sometimes is the case in disputes between little kids.
Yeah, no. I think that's absolutely right. So I think I would certainly not advise President Obama to sit down and negotiate with the leader of ISIS. That would be, you know, just the worst negotiation mistake ever. I'm sure he wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because it's ultimately legitimizing that leadership. On the other hand, might you get a third level, unofficial individual from the United States to somehow talk back channel with somebody from ISIS to better understand what their motivations are, why they're actually doing what they're doing? That's a wholly different situation. As to the question of conceding, I think people are scared to death to negotiate. There was a study done by some of my colleagues at Harvard Business School showing that, in fact, most CEOs, most business people are anxious about negotiation, you know, negotiation phobia. In reality, negotiation does not mean giving in. If you and I are negotiating, it means we're sitting down. I'm trying to understand where you're coming from. I'm listening. I'm trying to find some sort of outcome that can work for you, that can work for me.
Your wife is not the enemy, right?
She sometimes thinks I'm the enemy.
She thinks, right. And you wrote a book about negotiating the non-negotiable, and you use her as an example. Is it possible to teach the political courage to see your enemy's viewpoint, which is what has to happen to succeed in negotiation?
Within a safe space. You know, within a safe space. So much of my work is bringing different leadership together and behind closed doors, having them have the conversations that are very different than the public conversations. And to the question of my wife, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
So I mean, do I see her as the enemy? Is she me? There's this concept that I talk about in the book. I call it vertigo. It is this notion that we in a conflict situation can get so consumed in our conflict that we cannot see outside of it. You know, we get into the conflict at home and then we go to work. Our body is there at work, but our mind is still at home. That's vertigo. And I think there's a danger, whether it's in the personal situations and personal conflicts or in the international, that we get so sucked into that swirling tornado of vertigo that we lose track of what our purpose is, where we actually want to go.
Daniel Shapiro is the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program and associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, McLean Hospital. His book, Negotiating the Non-Negotiable, is out today. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
New Yorkers have their say today in the presidential primaries.
PJ from Montauk. I'm an independent, so I don't get to vote in the primary. And I did consider changing my party affiliation to help eliminate a nightmare candidate. But I gave up when I realized there are scary candidates in both primaries. Thanks.
New York is one of the 23 states that has a closed primary. Only registered Democrats and Republicans can vote. As of this month, 2.9 million of New York's 10.7 million active voters were not registered Democrats or Republicans. I'm one of them. Can vote. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.